Lecture 18. Thermopylae and the 300 Spartans.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello. We ended our last lecture with the Athenians rightly basking in the glory of their victory at Marathon. Well, the Athenian and Plataean victory, that is. But we hardly hear about the part played by the Plataeans in the battle because of Athenian propaganda. Herodotus downplays the role of the Plataeans. The Athenians are very happy to go along with this because it will give them the edge over the Spartans, something we talked about last time. In this lecture, we're going to examine events in Athens in the aftermath of the Battle of Marathon, and then turn to the arrival of Xerxes in Greece and discuss the famous Battle of Thermopylae in 480. The Athenian victory at Marathon had dramatic repercussions in the city. Until Marathon, the Alcmaeonidae family had dominated Athenian politics, as Cleisthenes had intended. If you remember, we made the point in our lectures on Cleisthenes that in redistributing the local power bases within Attica, he essentially left those of his own family, the Alcmaeonidae, alone. That meant that the family could continue to dominate political life because its power bases remained in and around Athens, where the assembly was meeting. Well, until Marathon, as I say, the Alcmaeonidae had dominated Athenian politics. But the Persian issue, and especially the Battle of Marathon itself, brought about a change in foreign policy. It became anti-Persian. And with it, there came a change in political leadership, a change that eclipsed the power of the Alcmaeonidae. Now, this confidence, if you like, can be seen in the people who are now prepared to hold their leaders accountable for their actions and not let them off, as seems to have been the case in the past. One glaring example of the people now prepared to hold their leaders accountable is Miltiades, the hero of Marathon. We might think that Miltiades would dominate political life for ages now, but this wasn't the case. Not long after Marathon, Miltiades was involved in a costly overseas venture. He was also gravely wounded in it. The Athenians fined him when he returned to Athens, but he died before he could pay the fine. And his son Cimon finally discharged the debt. In Athens, by the way, it was customary for children to inherit the debts of their fathers and to pay them back to the state. If they couldn't do this, very often, in certain cases, fines were doubled. So the Athenians were not prepared to let anybody off who died in debt to the state. Another example of this new confidence on the part of the people is the first recorded instance of ostracism in 488. Now, this procedure, ostracism, was introduced by Cleisthenes in 508, remember, as a safeguard to the constitution. It was a means of trying to get rid of anyone trying to subvert the democracy. And what I mean by confidence in the people is also that if the Alcmaeonidae had been in controlling political power so much during these years since Cleisthenes' legislation in 508 and now down to the Battle of Marathon in 490, well, that period of dominance was no more. Because now the people are prepared to put the foot down and say, no, we've had enough of this. We now want to start exiling leaders that we disagree with. We now want to start fining leaders who have proved to be corrupt or inept. So the Alcmaeonidae cannot control the people anymore. And ostracism is a wonderful example of that. From 487 down until 484, ostracism was used to get rid of pro-Persian leaders. So you see what I mean when I say that foreign policy now becomes anti-Persian. Anybody who's in favor of amicable relations with the Persians or brokering some sort of diplomatic contact can now find himself ostracized. Another interesting change as far as constitutional history is concerned is that in 487, about the same year as the first recorded ostracism, archons began to be chosen by lot. And they were chosen by lot from a pool that was put forward by the various tribes in just the same way as the tribes chose members to the boule. Now, we don't know how large the pool was, but it must have been an even number because of the 10 tribes. The upshot was that more men could now stand for the archonship, and with Lot, they had as much chance of being elected as the next man. At the same time, the people made sure that men who were put forward could do the job. Each candidate was subject to a preliminary test called a dokimasia. And at this dokimasia, or questioning, the candidate for the archonship had to answer various questions. And these questions were not just about his qualifications for the job, but also about his lifestyle. Did he have legitimate children? Had he buried his parents if they were dead? Did he own land within the borders? In other words, within Attica. So there's kind of a sort of moral element now comes into it. In addition to having the right qualifications, you also have to have led the right lifestyle. Now, why the change to election by lot? Well, the answer is that thanks to Marathon, people became aware of how important the role of the strategos was, the general, the strategos. Once strategoi, it's the plural form, remember, once strategoi crossed over into the political arena of the assembly and they began advising on political affairs, then competition for this office increased dramatically. And it increased dramatically because of the power that the strategos could wield. And remember, this is one office that is open to re-election any number of times, unlike the archons. Now, naturally, the strategos diluted the power of the archons, and by extension, the Areopagus. And a sign of the times was the Athenian term for politician. This strikes us a little bit strange, really. Here, the Athenians invent democracy, but they actually don't have a single word for politician. They have a number of words, actually, but the most common term that the Athenians use for what we would call politician is the phrase rhetores kai strategoi, rhetores kai strategoi, orators and generals. So you see that general becomes part of the phrase for politician. Now, one of the greatest of the Athenian leaders, and the most anti-Persian, I'd say, was Themistocles. In 493, he had served as archon, and during that time, he had the Piraeus, the area, there were three natural bays that together formed the Athenian harbour of the Piraeus. And he had had the Piraeus fortified. Then 10 years later, in 483, he persuaded the people to spend a budget surplus on building 100 new triremes. And the trireme was the main Greek warship. Now, that year, in 483, the Athenians had produced so much silver from the mines at Laurium, which were in southeast Attica, that, remember, these were the mines that they'd only started to exploit effectively in the later Pisistrated tyranny, that they had produced so much silver that they had a surplus. Wouldn't that be nice today? Aristides, one of the commanders of the Greek center at Marathon, proposed to the Athenians that they simply divvy up the surplus equally among all citizens. And the Athenians thought, this isn't a bad idea. But then someone had the bright idea of asking Apollo at Delphi what to do. And his answer was that the Athenians needed to place their safety on a wooden wall, clear as mud. Themistocles interpreted this oracular pronouncement as meaning the Athenians were to use this budget surplus to build not a wooden wall around the city, as some people thought, but ships. In other words, the wooden wall became the hulls of ships. And then the people thought, that sounds even better, let's do that. And so as a result, 100 new triremes were built. The trireme became the standard Greek warship. It was rowed by 170 rowers sitting in three banks of oars on each side, hence its name, trireme, tri meaning three. Despite its size, it was quite slick to manoeuvre, apparently. I'm not sure why, but that's what they tell me. It was about 120, perhaps 150 feet long, and it was about 18 to 20 feet wide or so. Its job was to ram enemy ships and sink them, because attached to the prow of the trireme was a reinforced curved bronze hook, for want of a better word, so that when the trireme smashed broadside into an enemy vessel, the hook would make a hole in the enemy vessel's hull. Then the trireme would pull back, and of course water would flow into an enemy vessel and sink it. That was the idea. Well, sometimes, of course, the front of the trireme was hooked so tightly onto the enemy vessel that it couldn't disengage. And when that happened, there would be hand-to-hand fighting, soldiers jumping from one trireme onto the other, hand-to-hand fighting until one got the upper hand, and then the ships could be separated. All in all, naval warfare was not a pleasant business. Themistocles' move, that is persuading the Athenians to build 100 new triremes, laid the foundations for the later naval victories over the Persians that we'll discuss in the next lecture. They also paved the way for Athens to become the leading naval force in Greece, and then to put together an empire. The nature of warfare is changing quickly now. Infantry battles were still necessary, but so also were naval battles, as the Battle of Lade had shown with the end of the Ionian Revolt. Now, after the Persians' defeat at Marathon, Herodotus tells us that Darius was bent on revenge. However, we have to wait 10 years before the Persians again sail into the Aegean. In 486, as I said last time, Darius died, and he was succeeded by his son Xerxes. Almost immediately, Xerxes was faced with problems in Egypt over increased taxation, and he had to deal with those first. It was only when the Egyptian problem was solved and that Xerxes felt sufficiently secure on the Persian throne that he could turn his attention properly to Greece. And in 481, that time had come. Herodotus states specifically that Xerxes intended to conquer all Greece, and that he sent messengers seeking earth and water to this effect. Now, by now, 481, news had reached the Greeks of the great fleet that Xerxes was preparing. He'd been levying money for this for the last year or so, so this wasn't completely unknown to the Greeks. And a number of states submitted almost immediately to Persia, or rather they Medized, as the technical term is called. The Greeks called the Persians Medes, and so any state that bowed to Persia was seen as Medizing, becoming pro-Persian. A number of those became pro-Persian as soon as these messengers from Xerxes arrived demanding earth and water, because the news was he was coming after the Greeks big time. Now, how Xerxes crossed from Asia to Europe is famous. He bridged the Hellespont with a pontoon bridge. It was made up of boats lashed together, over which a causeway was built, and then his army, his land army, marched over this. Since the distance was over a mile, this was a great engineering feat. He also remembered how Mardonius had been wrecked in 492 off Mount Athos, which is on one of those prongs of the Chalcidice. And Xerxes now ordered the building of a canal across Mount Athos, in other words, that cut through Mount Athos, so that his fleet could sail safely through the canal and escape the winds and the swells that are very common around the Chalcidic Peninsula and that wreaked havoc with Mardonius's invasion in 492. Remember, he had to turn back to Persia. It was aborted. So this canal was also seen as a great engineering feat. Anyway, Xerxes' crossing was successful. He got his army across the Hellespont, his fleet sailed alongside the coastline, went through the Athos Canal, everybody was happy. And since Thrace was already part of the Persian Empire and Macedonia was pro-Persian, Xerxes was in northern Greece within a relatively short period of time. Now, Herodotus lists the various parts of the Persian invasion force. And when one adds up the numbers, we get a total force of 5,283,320. Now, this seems impossibly high. I mean, think about the supplies that would be needed to feed and water an army of over 5 million. Herodotus doesn't question it at all. Actually, he remarks that he wasn't surprised that the army drank rivers dry in the areas through which it marched, because the rivers couldn't provide enough water for that many men. Herodotus is likely, I think, to have confused the entire fighting strength of the vast Persian army. Because remember, the Persian Empire stretched from present-day Bulgaria to Pakistan. And so this vast area may well have been able to furnish 5 million men of fighting age for the Persian army. Modern historians put Xerxes' land force at around 200,000 men and the fleet at around 600 to 800 ships. Regardless of the numbers, there's no question that the Persian fleet was superior to anything the Greeks could assemble. In the face of the Persian danger, all of the Athenian exiles were recalled in 481. That's those who'd been ostracized in the past or sent away from the city for other reasons. Including those ostracized in previous years was Aristides. He was back on the scene now. Now, ostracisms didn't stop, though. It's very interesting. The Athenian constitution tells us that people who were ostracized now had to live close to the city of Athens just in case they were needed. And if they chose not to live close to the city of Athens, then, in the words of the Athenian constitution, quote, they would be completely outlawed. Presumably, this means that they would never be allowed to return to live in the city, even after the 10-year period of ostracism ended. In the meantime, the Spartans called a meeting of the Greek states at Corinth to discuss strategy, and they also wanted to create an alliance against Persia as well. In relation to this meeting or this conference, it's interesting that Herodotus talks about Spartans summoning states that were, quote, still loyal to the general cause, unquote. This qualification reminds us that several states had already Medized, so not all of the Greeks were loyal to the Greek cause. Some of them were already pro-Persian. Now, Herodotus goes on to tell us that this conference had the aim of patching up quarrels among the various states, and that once again reveals the fundamental weakness in the polis system. You shouldn't have to patch up quarrels, should you? This conference agreed to do five things. One, to make pledges of loyalty against Persia and those Greek states that had Medized. Two, to try to end the enmity between participants in the alliance. Three, to send embassies to powerful states that had not turned up. Nothing really came out of that. Four, to send spies into Asia to find out what Xerxes was up to. And finally, five, and this isn't actually in Herodotus, to decide who is going to be the overall commander of the Greek forces. Now, some 31 states turned up to this meeting, and they formed an alliance that modern historians call the Hellenic League. You'd think that given the threat to the mainland from Xerxes' enormous army, which is pretty much in Greece by now, the Greeks would have been quick to unite, but far from it. That last item, to decide who was going to be the overall commander, was the one that caused the massive problem. Because the Spartans said, we should be the commanders because, hey, we've got the toughest land army in Greece, we've got the best trained force, and we head the Peloponnesian League. But the Athenians, of course, hooked their thumbs in their belts and they said, yeah, but we defeated the Persians at Marathon. So it looked like a stalemate until finally the Athenians backed down and they agreed that Sparta would be in command of the Greek force. Spartan general called Eurybiades was made commander-in-chief of all of the league's land and naval forces. Now, the Greeks decided that the best strategy would be to defend a place that was as narrow as possible and as far north as possible. The further north, the better, obviously, to stop the Persians penetrating into central Greece and then southern Greece. Hence, Thessaly made the most sense. The idea behind the narrow place was the Persian cavalry would be ineffective. So the lesson of Marathon had been learned. Although the Persian forces were numerically superior to the Greeks, as we said, only a fraction of the Persian infantry was of the best fighting stock. And the cavalry would be ineffective in a narrow prepared defence. And that's why the Greeks targeted Thermopylae on the Malian Gulf. This was a narrow pass which was controlled by a gate, hence its name, because Thermopylae means hot gates. It's a reference to the hot sulphur springs that you can still see there. Now, Thermopylae was a pass that commanded the route south from Thessaly. It had the sea to its north, and it was surrounded by mountains to its south. There was simply no chance for Persian cavalry to be deployed there, an excellent strategic place. So in June of 480, a force of 6,000, 7,000 or so Greeks marched to Thermopylae under the command of the Spartan king Leonidas. Now, this was a relatively small number, 6,000, 7,000, and so it may even have been a vanguard with more troops to be sent later on. At the same time as this force was marching northwards, a fleet of Greek ships was sent to the north of Euboea, off Artemisium, and this fleet was under the command of Themistocles. Now, the Greek force fortified a position at Thermopylae overlooking the Persians. And for 2 days, the Persians attacked them with everything they had. But they couldn't break through. Leonidas and his troops faced them and were successful in preventing them, that's the Persians, rushing them and getting through Thermopylae because of the topography. But there was a downside to the place. And that was, there was a narrow path that ran from in front of the pass and over it, so that anyone who took it could come out behind the Greek contingent at the mouth of the pass. In other words, anybody who took this narrow path could encircle the Greeks there. Persians at the front, Persians at the back. Now, to make sure that no Persians discovered this path, Leonidas ordered the Phocian contingent, those are soldiers from the state of Phocis in central Greece, they were given the job of guarding it. Well, Herodotus tells us that on the third day of the Persian attack, a Greek traitor betrayed this path to Xerxes. Xerxes immediately ordered his crack infantry corps, these so-called immortals, up there. They cut through the Phocians and they took command of this road. And so they were able to turn the tables on Leonidas. Leonidas now found himself cut off between two lines of Persians, the immortals to his rear and the Persians under Xerxes at his front. Now, the Greek force at Thermopylae held a conference. What are we going to do? Some of the Greeks were in favor of leaving before their obvious defeat at Persian hands, and others, especially Leonidas, were intent on resisting Persia at all costs. In the end, Leonidas dismissed the Greek army, apart from his 300 Spartans and a contingent of Thebans and Thespians. Perhaps also he remembered the words of the Delphic oracle that said a Spartan king had to die for the Greeks to defeat the Persians. And so it wasn't just the Spartan psyche that made him take this course of action, of staying to the end. Maybe he was also trying to fulfill the words of the oracle to help Greece defeat the Persians. Either way, this contingent of Greeks faced the immortals who poured into the pass and eventually cut down the Greeks to the last man. The immortals suffered too, especially at the hands of the Spartans. And included in the immortals who died that day were two of Xerxes' brothers. So ended the first battle of the Persian Wars on Greek soil. The Battle of Thermopylae was therefore a Persian victory. And Xerxes ordered the corpse of Leonidas to be brought to him, and then he had it crucified for all to see. In the meantime, the whole of Boeotia Medized. And Boeotia, as we know, borders on Attica. So the Persians are now getting dangerously close to Attica and then through the Isthmus into the Peloponnese. Now, the movie 300 that came out in 2007 vividly depicts the events at Thermopylae. It's far-fetched in parts. I mean, the Persians honestly didn't have a rhinoceros or elephants at Thermopylae. The immortals didn't have masks to hide mummified faces. And Xerxes didn't look like he wanted to get into the Guinness Book of World Records for the most piercings, or dressed like an outcast from Cats. Then again, this was the movie version of the Frank Miller graphic novel that was based on the battle, and people often overlook this. But the battle scenes in it, in the movie 300, were extraordinarily real. And they showed us how fiercely the Greeks fought, how frustrated Xerxes and the Persians became, and how Leonidas stood firm for glory and honour when all was lost. When you remember that this battle really did happen, I actually found the final few scenes of the movie, as the 300 are cut down and then the camera pans over their bodies, punctured with numerous arrows, I found those last scenes far more moving than I ever thought they would be. I was moved more than I thought I would be, because it really happened. It's the Spartans' heroism at Thermopylae that is remembered more than the Persian victory. I mean, if the road around the pass had not been betrayed to Xerxes, who knows what would have happened? The longer the Persians were unable to break the Greeks, the more time for Greek reinforcements to march north to support them. And perhaps even some of those powerful Medi states might think of switching back to the Greek cause. At the same time, Spartan propaganda quietly forgot about the role of the Thebans and Thespiaeans. Just like the Athenians relegated the Plataean part in the victory at Marathon to relative oblivion. The Spartans' bravery made such a great impression on the Greeks that the defeat at Thermopylae became a morale victory for the Greeks. It also made a great impression on the Persians, because they were beginning to wonder who they were up against. I mean, here we are, we Persians. We give Leonidas the chance to surrender. We outnumber him by, millions to one just about. And then he says, no, I'm not going to surrender. And there's that famous exchange that took place where the Persians say that there are so many of them that their arrows, when they fire their arrows, they'll block out the sun. And Leonidas apparently replied, well then, we'll just have to fight in the shade. The courage of the 300 Spartans became legendary throughout history, and it's led to them being emulated a lot of the time. Think of the Alamo in 1846. And I'm sure you can think of a lot of other examples throughout history that I can't think of. We remember the Spartan ethos of standing firm in battle, of not running away because of the shame this would bring to families and state. And nothing can end this lecture better than the epitaph written for the 300 by the poet Simonides. This epitaph was put up at Thermopylae, so that anybody who visited the site of the battle and knew what happened there would be able to read this epitaph and think about it. It's a very sobering one. And it really just, it brings home to us how the Spartans saw their role in the state. And I'm going to finish this lecture by quoting it. It says, "Go tell the Spartans, you stranger who passes by, that here, obeying their laws, we lie."